Welcome to the Wednesday Conversation. I'm Mike Kresnick, and I'm here with Pastor Bob Thune, Pastor Dusty White, and Chris Hemmelman of Coram Deo Church. Every Wednesday, we sit down to talk about how the gospel of Jesus Christ connects to the questions and issues of everyday life. And today, we're taking some time to look back over the last 10 years. Coram Deo celebrates 10 years of life this month. And so we're just going to take time to talk about those last 10 years. Dusty, when I say 10 years for Coram Deo, what's the first thing that pops into your head?
First thing that pops into my mind is how when Coram Deo planted, I was in California. So that's one of the things that pops into my mind. The other thing that pops right away into my mind is gospel-centered life, sonship, gospel transformation, learning all kinds of things about the gospel that became the early DNA of Coram Deo, even though I wasn't around for that. I was well aware and kind of, it's funny, JC and I had an interesting relationship with Coram Deo in the early days as kind of a proxy just by living in the Bay Area for the first few years. And so those are the first things that come to my mind. Bob, how about for you?
Gosh, I mean, this has been the last 10 years of my life, so there's lots. I actually think back to where my kids were 10 years ago, you know, and how different our family life is now than it was when we first began, and sort of going through the whole decade of my 30s, really, in planting a church and trying to lead a church and making mistakes and figuring it out. So there's a lot that comes into my head. Chris, what were you doing 10 years ago, 2005?
If I'd have known Coram Deo existed 10 years ago, I might not have moved to the East Coast. I might have moved to Omaha. Because in my mind, a church like Coram Deo didn't exist in the Midwest.
So you moved to the East Coast to find one?
So I was an angry, frustrated dude 10 years ago and getting ready to contemplate moving from the Midwest.
That's funny because there was a lot of angry, frustrated dudes that kind of formed our early core teams.
I was sitting in a crummy apartment in Wayne, Nebraska. My wife and I had been married a year, and I had I'm from Omaha, but I had no idea Coram Deo was even around. I hadn't heard of Bob Thune or Acts 29 or anything, and so I was completely oblivious to what God was doing in Omaha 10 years ago.
Well, the reality is 10 years ago, it didn't really exist. It was kind of an idea, right?
It was just coming to birth. We had had our first meeting at 1316 Jones Street with our core team, which was about 60 people. So this time 10 years ago, I think would have been the second week of Coram Deo's actual existence.
Hmm. What was going through your mind at that point, Bob? Let's get real. Because it's an idea to plant a church, and there's a little bit of momentum. There's a few people that want to follow you, or that will.
I think I was probably scared spitless 10 years ago, because it's one thing to conceive of something and then to get permission to do it and actually go do it. So I knew I had the church that sent us out guaranteed my salary through December of 2005. So I knew I at least had 4 months that I was going to get paid, and after that, who knew? And so I think it was a little bit of, you know, there was this blend of excitement of doing something new and a little bit of, you know, being freaked out of like, this could really go badly. And, you know, not only for me and for my livelihood, but like, man, people, you know, if we lead people in a wrong direction, that could be really bad for them and for the city. And so there's a lot of pressure and a lot of, you know, I don't want to say anxiety because that's not really what I feel, but there was definitely a lot of pressure in those early months of like, man, now we got to actually do what we said we're going to do.
When did that flip? When did that go from like, man, I don't know if this is going to work out to, oh man, this is something the Spirit is involved with. God is here.
I think it took, well, I sensed that the Spirit was involved in it from the beginning, but it probably took a year and a half before it felt stable. Hmm. You know, when Walker got here, when we aligned with Acts 29, I went through Acts 29 assessment in the fall of 2006. That sort of felt like, okay, now we have our feet under us a little bit, and we had enough people. I think we were 120, 130 in that fall of 2006. So it sort of felt like, okay, there's a little bit of stability here. You know, this thing's not as fragile as it was at the beginning.
So if you were to compare Coramdale 10 years ago to now, would you say that's... So of course, there are certain things that change, but what about sort of the core identity of Coramdale, sort of the core philosophy, the heartbeat of Coramdale? Would you say it's changed much, developed much, or would you say that from the beginning it's largely stayed the same and just more has kind of developed around how to live those things out? If that question makes sense.
Yeah, I think the DNA of it is surprisingly all the same. I mean, you wouldn't notice much difference at all if you dialed the clock back and walked in the room 10 years ago as far as the core convictions and the ways that we're trying to embrace the gospel and live it out. I think hopefully what's changed is a little more maturity in how we do that and think about that. And probably, you know, in the early years, we pushed gospel community so hard that it was almost like Sunday mornings were a secondary thing. And that was good in the early year or two, because, or in the first year or two, because it you know, our Sunday mornings actually weren't that good. So no disrespect to those of us that were leading it, but it just, you know, we could not compete with the kinds of Sunday morning experiences you had all over the city. And so we were in a sense leveraging the one thing that we felt like we had that was unique, which was these communities of discipleship and mission that were really the places where spiritual formation was taking place. And I think you'd notice now probably a little more emphasis on the Sunday morning as a part of that formative experience, a piece of what is necessary for me to become a disciple. And I think we probably underestimated and downplayed that in the early years and sometimes in obnoxious ways, probably.
So tell me about the genesis of that DNA. What influences on you, were the things you read, people in your life that were the catalyst for that DNA that you wanted to bring to Coramdale?
Yeah, it's hard. It's funny to think back because if you... So right now, the phrase gospel-centered, even the idea of having a gospel-centered church or moving to a city and looking for a gospel-centered church, that's somewhat normal within evangelical culture these days. 10 years ago, there was none of that. I mean, the Gospel Coalition came online in 2007, I think, was the first Gospel Coalition conference with Tim Keller and D.A. Carson and those guys. And so when we planted, there was no... camaraderie around that idea. So the genesis of that DNA was being in churches where it was very subculture-ish and there was a lot of pressure to conform to an external standard of morality or of dress or a language or a culture, and feeling that, no, that's not what the gospel invites us. The gospel is something deeper than that and something fuller than that and something richer than that and something that's different than that. And so instead of calling people to conform to a culture that's religious and that's churchy, what if we put the gospel at the center of a church and try to just invite people to that as best we can? And so I don't think we've done that perfectly. I don't think you ever can, but that idea, that was the sort of so you had this gospel centrality piece of the gospel being not just the way into the Christian life, but the key to sanctification and growth and transformation. And then you had this missional piece, which was a lot of the guys back then were in Australia. It was Alan Hirsch, and it was some of the guys in that stream that were talking about missional church. I remember I went to a training seminar with Hugh Halter back in the early part of 2005. And he was talking about, you know, missional community and missional church and learning to be missionaries in our own culture and adopting a missionary mindset, the church being a movement. And all of these things were, he was taking frustrations I had and ideas that I'd had and sort of putting them into a coherent picture that said, yeah, that's what we want to do. So that, as I describe, it was funny, Chris, because I was talking with a guy a few weeks ago, and he said, okay, if you had to just, what's your sort of elevator speech for what Coramdale is? You know, if you have 2 minutes in an elevator with somebody, how do you explain it? And really, I said, well, we've always said gospel-centered, missional. You know, those are always the two adjectives that we've used to say we want the gospel at the center, and we want to be a church of missionaries and a church that is a missionary church in the city. And those were revolutionary ideas 10 years ago in ways that they're not now. And I'm thankful that they're not. More churches and more leaders have seen that and adopted that and bought into that and had their thinking reframed by that. But 10 years ago, that was quite unusual in our city, at least.
Bob, talk to us about the name Coram Deo.
Did you say Corndale?
No, Coram Deo. Coram space Deo.
We probably had a month of debate about the name. And when I say we, I mean me and the interns that were involved with it. So I wasn't like, let's take a vote on this. I was, let's keep this real small. So there was five or six of us that were debating what should we name this thing. And we had a whiteboard of probably 10 good names that we thought were decent. Some of them were like, I mean, I always loved the name Mosaic because it has that idea of brokenness coming together and wholeness. But, you know, back then Mosaic was Irma McManus' church in L.A. And so, you know, it sort of already had an identity. There's a lot of names we liked, but somebody else was already using them in ways that we were like, well, that's going to define how people think about it. The biggest conviction I had is we really wanted a church that would reach unchurched people. And so we felt like if we name it blah, blah, blah community church or even just blah, blah, blah church, you immediately put up that barrier that people have to church. So how do we name it something that people will have no idea what it is when we say it? It's kind of that's actually our idea was, how do we name it something that when we say we're a part of this, people have to ask a follow-up question. And so that's how we landed on the name Coram Deo. We felt like, well, Coram Deo, no one knows what that is. And so it's they're going to have to ask, well, what is that? You know? And so it's not going to raise the defenses that the name, you know, the word church sometimes raises for people.
So you thought the best way to reach the non-Christian was to sound like a cult.
Yeah, brilliant. Yeah, I mean, something like that. You know, I don't...
What was going on in Omaha in 2005?
Well, it was also, right, so we're trying to say, how do we reach unchurched people, but also how do we name ourselves something that has a rich connection to the heritage theologically that we want to be aligned with, which is the Reformed tradition. And so Coram Deo was this byword and this phrase back in the Reformation that meant before the face of God, and the Reformers used it to describe what it meant to live life for the glory of God, that it means that we live every moment of our existence as though we're living before the face of God. And so we liked the idea that grabbed this rich sort of theological heritage that we wanted to embrace, but it also was different enough that people wouldn't immediately go, oh yeah, you're probably just like that church down the street.
Can you... explain the nuance between the difference between church community and community church, why you flip those words around?
Yeah. So in the church growth movement back, you know, again, for some people who are listening, well, you know, they're like, we're swimming in a stream that you're not maybe that familiar with, but the church growth movement was a big deal in the 80s and the early 90s. And it was all about how you grow a church. And that was all this emphasis and energy to, you know, churches should grow. And here's all the tips and tricks and tools and pragmatic things you can do to grow your church. And one of the things was everybody started changing their name to such and such community church, because a community church in that movement was a big church that attracts the whole community. So it has this sense of like, it's for the whole community. And, you know, it's attracting people from all these neighborhoods. And we wanted to flip that around and say, because we believe the church is a people, not a place, if we call it community church, it has a sense of like that it's a building within this community. And the opposite of that would be a church community, which is a people defined by their relationship to Christ who then live on mission within this community. So it's a subtle difference, but we felt like in calling it Coram Deo church community, we wanted to even in that embrace the idea that we're the called and sent people of God. We're called to Christ and sent out by Christ for the good of the city.
So how does a gospel-centered, missional, reformed church have donuts and chocolate milk for communion? Is that like the missional piece there? Well, let me explain that.
That happened?
Listen,
that's what I heard.
My buddy Kurt, he probably won't listen to this podcast, but he still lives in the city. Kurt was a guy that was on our launch team, and he's a great dude. He was the only guy in our whole church that had a seminary degree. So this was like the highest, the most theologically educated guy in our church in the early years. But he also had a chip on his shoulder about church and evangelicalism, and so he was real into like the emergent church, which back then was what all the, you know, goofy guys were reading who didn't want to be mainstream. And so I was like, well, this guy is a seminary, you're going to put him in charge of communion. I mean, what, you know, it's like communion's a high thing and a holy thing, and so he'll, you know, he's a good guy to lead it. And so I trusted him. I was like, hey man, you just do whatever. And he did, you know, he did great. It was, you know, this wasn't the only thing he did. He actually, there were many weeks we had a normal communion, but yeah, this one week he brought donuts and chocolate milk for communion. And
sweet Jesus.
And he had some way that he set it up of like, you know, this, he was trying to like jerk us out of our established traditions. And so he's like, you know, we shouldn't look at this as something somber, but as something celebratory. And so, you know, there were ways he was trying to frame it where I was like, yeah, I see what you're saying there. But needless to say, after that Sunday, Kirk got moved off the communion team. That wasn't probably what we wanted to innovate with. But those are some of the stories that we have to tell from the early years.
That's good. That's real good.
In the history of Coram Deo, have you ever done a Journey cover?
Oh.
During worship?
Wow.
We've never... Not only have we not done a Journey cover, I don't think we've ever covered any song.
We covered Mumford & Sons, Awake
My Soul.
Oh, we did,
yeah. We did Awake My Soul.
Okay.
The chorus.
So not Crazy Train.
Yeah, none of the... I mean, again, man, that was like... I was so fed up with that kind of stuff coming out of some of the churches I had that were very into like, this is how we attract a non-Christian is we play the music they're familiar with. I was just like, no, that's not going to work. Like, they're not like, oh, that was better than Journey, you know, when you covered that song. I mean, no non-Christian is like, man, the band at my church is like such a great cover band. You know, that's
they're
not
waiting
what's
for the catch.
Gonna, yeah,
like,
that's not what's
church gonna, still, right? Like, when are you going to transition?
Yeah.
So, shifting gears to a little more serious question.
Hey, real quick before that, how did the first baptism take place?
you've probably seen the pictures of the deck. It was the spring of 2006. And we had walked, number one, we'd seen some people come to Christ, and then there were some other people in the church that just hadn't been baptized yet since their profession of faith in Christ. And so we were like, well, let's do a baptism. And so it was right when the spring weather hit and it was getting warm, and we did it outside on the deck at 1316 Jones Street. And we didn't have a lot of water. So we got this, there was a girl whose dad, I think, worked at like Tractor Supply Company or something. So he donated this horse tank, which was actually pretty small. Like it was like the size of a really small bathtub.
Like,
you got to work to get wet.
Goat tank.
And so, I mean, I baptized Paul Gardner, Tony Weirs, some large men in this thing. And it's like, if you look at those pictures, it's clear that I'm trying to like get them down enough
get
into
in
the
there.
Water that they're actually wet. Out. So it was really fun. It was a fun moment for our church, but it was, I mean, you know, you're doing what you can with a baptismal that you're making up on the fly. And it was interesting.
So with that, my question was, tell us a story of a conversion in the church that you would say was just maybe surprising or just kind of a radical conversion within the church where you're like, wow, God really moved to save this person.
So my favorite story in that regard is Scott Grazer, who's still part of our church. Scott showed up on our one-year anniversary. I remember it because it was the Derek Webb concert. We had Derek Webb come and play a show on our one-year anniversary, and so we met for church that morning, and then Derek was playing in the evening, and the show in the evening was sort of we invited the whole city to. So Scott showed up at church that morning, and you know, if you've ever met Scott, he's a motorcycle guy, big, huge, you know, long beard, just kind of a rough, tough-looking guy.
You don't meet him in an alley.
Yeah, and our church was a bunch of 25-year-old, you know, cool guys with, you know, that worked in the tech industry or that, you know, were like waiters down at the restaurant. So, like, he just did not fit the ethos of our church at that time. And it was great. I remember meeting him, and he came back that night for the concert and connected with us. And then Will Walker and I, shortly after that, were starting an intro missional community where we were just trying to pull some people in that were new to the church. And so Scott started coming to that. And long story short, I don't know how long this season was in his life, but he came to faith. He was at that time estranged from his wife, and he and his wife were at odds. And I remember he drove to our office one day. He's a carpet layer, so he was out working, and he pulled his van up outside our office one day and came in and said, "Guys, I was just reading in the Gospels, and Jesus said something about that you shouldn't get divorced." And he's like, I mean, I'm on that path. Like I'm working my way that direction. So I was just coming here asking you guys, like, should I not be doing that? So Will and I sat down and we were like, man, yeah, you shouldn't be, or at least we need to talk about that. And so let's talk about what's going on. So that led us into a whole season with Scott and Karen and their marriage, and the Walkers really investing in them. And so Scott coming to faith there, and then his wife and son getting pulled into Coram Deo. There's just a ton of good redeeming work that God did there. So that was a fun, it was just fun because I can still remember, you know, walking up to preach that Sunday and looking out there and being like, that dude could probably take me out. I hope he's not mad by anything I say because he looks intimidating, you know. And he became one of the biggest teddy bears in our church and just a man who loves the Lord and has been a faithful part of our church for a decade now.
Bob, looking back over the last 10 years, what are some of the lessons that you've learned?
I've been reflecting on that question. Here are two things at least that I've that I've recognized. One, you can do a lot more in 10 years than you think. And two, you end up doing a lot less in 10 years than you think. It's interesting to me how this sort of paradoxically works. So I think by now I thought, man, we would have planted 5 or 6 or 7 churches in Omaha. You know, by 10 years in, man, we're a church planting movement. That just takes so much longer than you think. And the reason is because discipleship takes longer than you think, and raising up leaders takes longer than you think. And so the slow, patient work of discipling people and moving leaders along the path to where they're ready for that kind of leadership is just, it's a slower process than I gave it credit for. And that's been, it's been good for the Lord to sort of slow us down and make us more patient with that. At the same time, you can get a lot more done in 10 years than you think. So when I think we've been slower in the pace of church planting than we would have liked to have been, but, the fruitfulness of what God's done in the lives of individual people has been astounding. And so when you think about the people who've come to Christ through Coram Deo, the people who've been discipled, the people who've gotten married or had children, or, I mean, there's been a lot of life that's happened in the last 10 years and a lot of the people that are a part of our church. And it's been fun to see how much has taken place in 10 years. So it's interesting because I think as I look back, I think, gosh, more has happened than I expected and less has happened than I expected. Some things have been faster than I thought and some things a lot slower than I thought. And so I think it's reiterated for me, you can't grow or plant or multiply any faster than you can make disciples. And so the thing we were committed to at the beginning and have always tried to be committed to and haven't always been as faithful in as we would like to have been is just the creating a context where people can actually become disciples of Jesus and really lighting a fire under that and saying, let's not be a church where people just show up, put in their time, punch their Jesus card, go on with life. But let's be a church where you either have to become a disciple here or you get uncomfortable, you know? And that when you're creating that kind of a church culture, things are slower than you think they will be. But the fruitfulness and the results are also more rich than you expect them to be.
We talk about all these cool things that God has done in the last 10 years, and we're just scraping the surface here as far as the history of God working in the people of Coram Deo. But why do we look back? Why do we look back on these things and celebrate? You know, we just had a party last weekend. We partied on Friday night with our members, and we partied on Sunday morning with our congregation. Why do we do those things? Why do we take the time to celebrate?
One of the simple answers, Mike, is that we celebrate because it's one of the things the gospel invites us to do. And we have a tendency in American culture to be very focused on the next thing and very sort of rigorous about the next thing on our calendar. I don't know that we do a very good job with gratitude, with slowing down and thanking the Lord, with looking back, and even just with playfulness, you know, just having fun together. And so I think especially for a young, driven church full of young, driven people, the discipline of stepping back, standing back, slowing down, celebrating, telling stories, laughing together, remembering funny things that happened in the past, this is all a part of actually inhabiting the greater story that we're a part of that oftentimes we, because we get our heads down, we lose sight of that and we don't actually celebrate well. Dusty, you were reading some stuff about just the discipline of celebration.
Yeah, I was reading, sometimes I go back to this discipline of celebration that Foster talks about in his book, Celebration of Discipline, which is captured obviously in the title, but not everybody who writes on spiritual disciplines talks about celebration, and Foster does, and he says, celebration brings joy into life and makes us strong. Scripture tells us that the joy of the Lord is our strength, and he's quoting Nehemiah there. Celebration is central to all the spiritual disciplines. Without a joyful spirit of festivity, life becomes dull, death-breathing tools in the hands of modern Pharisees. That sounds pretty intense. But then he goes on to say, joy is part of the fruit of the Spirit, Galatians 5, obviously. Often I am inclined to think that joy is the motor, the thing that keeps everything else going. Without joyous celebration to infuse the other disciplines, we will sooner or later abandon them. And he's talking about prayer and Bible reading and things that we engage in. Joy produces energy. Joy makes us strong.
I like his framing of joy as a discipline, because I think most people think of joy as just a spontaneous mm-hmm. feeling or emotion that I have. But what he's saying is, no, joy is a discipline of celebration.
And I think especially it's important for if you've been a Christian for a long time. You know, you can tend to think like, well, yeah, I read my Bible and I pray and I go to church and I serve and I do these, I give and what else now? But what's hard is when veteran Christians become kind of joyless or boring to be around, or they've kind of numbed out. And so it's just important to celebrate and to see that as a discipline, to push pause on life and celebrate.
That's going to do it for this week's conversation. Join us next week as we take time to look forward. And I look forward to talking about looking forward with you guys. Please join the conversation by tweeting us, interacting with us on Twitter at Coram Deo Omaha. And we'll talk to you again next week on the Wednesday Conversation.